Hi, I'm Len Epp from LeanPub, and in this episode of the LeanPub podcast, I'll be interviewing Rich Allen. Based in Bournemouth, Rich is an independent consultant and socio-technical architect and founder of Conjurer Solutions, which works with fast-growing tech organizations to cultivate happier and more effective teams. You can follow him on LinkedIn at Richard Allen and check out his websites at facilitatingfastflow.com, as well as conjurersolutions.co.uk and usernneedsmapping.com. Rich is the author of the book User Needs Mapping, Aligning Teams Around What Matters. In the book, Rich offers a practical visual method for reconnecting your organization to the people it's meant to serve. Whether you're leading a digital transformation, evolving your team structures, or simply trying to reduce friction and focus on what matters most, this book gives you the tools you need. In this interview, we're going to talk about Rich's background and career, professional interests, his book, and at the end, we'll talk a little bit about his experience writing and self-publishing a book. So thank you very much, Rich, for being on the LeanPub podcast.
No worries. Thanks very much for inviting me. It's great to be here.
I always like to start these interviews by asking people for their origin story. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you found your way into a career in kind of tech and consulting.
Cool. Yeah, no problem. So basically, I was born in a town called Bedfordshire, or a county called Bedfordshire, just north of London. But when I was young, moved down to the south coast or the southwest in a town called Yeovil. Grew up there and ended up in Bournemouth, going to Bournemouth University. And it's at that place where I went to, did a degree in microelectronics and computing. So that kind of put me on the track towards software development. It started off with doing hardware and software. And I gravitated towards the software track. And then graduated. I was at university from 96 to 99. Graduated from that, went to Australia for 4 months for a little sabbatical whilst I waited for my now wife to finish her university course. And then I kind of went into the world of work, started at a small startup called High Integrity Solutions, which was focusing on building software for companies like BAE Systems, and we were building the what was referred to the V design system at the time. So very much waterfall, starting off with doors requirements, goal structuring notation, and then tracking those requirements across into using UML tools and all those kind of things. So and when I was there, I was kind of focusing on the document generation tool, which was trying to bring everything together using sort of CSS and HTML and all those kind of things back in 2001 or two, something like that. And then from there, I kind of naturally gravitated actually into a sort of leadership role. So I ended up leading the team, even though I was fresh out of university. And then that seemed to be my kind of way that I would work. I'd go into a role and I was always start off doing the hands-on coding and I'd end up in a leadership position until around probably 2007, where I thought I'd found my dream job at the time. And I was working at a small CMS kind of based company, and they were paying me a good wage. It was a really friendly environment. We would go and play football at lunchtime, we'd kick about and things, and then a colleague, I thought it was my best job I'd ever found, and then a colleague of mine said, oh, do you want to go independent contracting? So at that time I was like, oh, maybe I should or shouldn't. This was around 2007. And I thought, okay, let's go for it. So I went independent back in 2007. Now, at the same time, my wife declared she was pregnant. And also the 2008 crash kicked in. And I also decided to start up a user group as well. So I was, you know, just in a whole new world, but go for it. And then, so I've been independent since 2008, essentially. working in various different roles, typically as going in as an independent contractor, hands-on coding, behavior-driven development, test-driven development, all those kind of things. And then ultimately got to, did that in various different roles and ended up working with Pure Gym in about 2015. Now, so this is, we're now kind of getting to 2015 time. And that's where the next kind of big shift happened. So I've been hands-on coding. We were doing software development for that team. We were bringing their team in-house. So they had all of their software development was done outside of the team. I was kind of contractor number four. We started growing their team. And at that point, we had, we were implementing good modern software development practices. So we were kind of doing cloud-based development, continuous deployment, behavior-driven development, test-driven development, all of those good things. And the team got to around 20 or so. And at that point, they wanted to add more developers to the team. And so from that point onwards, I was trying to, I was trying to say to them that I've probably gone into too much detail here.
No. It's great to hear these stories. A lot of people.
So basically, as the team was growing, my natural inclination was to say, well, the processes that we have are not going to support adding more people. So we were doing 16 deploys a day, blue-green deployment, single piece flow. It's all kind of good stuff. But in order to double the team size, it wasn't going to work. And at the time, I was really into kind of systems thinking. I'd read Donella Matthews kind of thinking in systems. And I was trying to kind of speak to the senior leadership and say, that Pure Gym's like a bathtub or like a series of bathtubs, where the work's flowing through these different bathtubs. And that didn't really land. But then in 2019, the Team Topologies book came out. And Team Topologies kind of just said everything that I'd been trying to say up until that point. And so we kind of spoke to senior leadership and say, look, this is what we've been trying to say. We should do something like this. And that became a real catalyst for change at Pure Gym. So we actually started thinking in those terms about how to start to organize the teams. And it very much kind of aligned with my thinking about how work should flow. And so at that point then, I wanted to learn more from Team Topologies. So I reached out to Matthew and Manuel, who authored the book, and said, where can I learn more? And they said, well, can you write a case study about what you've done? Because actually you're the first person to have read the book and applied it somewhere. Hmm. So they'd worked with lots of other organizations to write the book, but no one had bought the book and then tried it. So I put together that case study with the then solution architect, Pure Gym. You can find it on the website at teamtopologies.com/Pure Gym. And then the rest, then it was a significant shift in my, in what I did. So I went from doing hands-on coding to helping other organizations then try to do the same thing. And I've been working since 2020 with the kind of core team at Team Topologies doing that. And that kind of brings me up to where the book came from.
Yeah, thanks very much for telling that great story. It's nice to see this sort of professional and technical and personal kind of all woven together. That way, it's interesting the number of or the proportion of LeanPub authors who, you know, obviously people who are sort of self starters and stuff who sort of had this moment where they kind of went independent. That's actually often kind of like, you know, key part of the story. It's not normally at the beginning of a financial crisis and a first child that begins to go independent. So that's interesting to hear that, and that you sort of obviously thrived. One question I wanted to ask you, it's a little bit random, but like it does come up on the podcast from time to time, is, I mean, given our, I think we're relatively similar vintage, is if you were starting out in a career now in like tech, would you do a full university degree?
Yeah, that's a good one. And I think a degree and the university experience to me is more than just the degree that you get. So the whole life experience, moving away from home, doing all of those things. So there is definite benefits to, like, just social benefits, getting out into the world. With regards to kind of doing the degree itself for what it brings to the table, I guess degrees that are kind of helping with critical thinking and problem solving and pulling things together, I think are just still really, really valuable. So yes, I would, if people are passionate about it and want to do it, I'd still encourage them to definitely do that. Do they need to do it? Possibly not, because there's so much information available. If they want to get out into the world, they can. There's lots of different ways to get into the industry now, I think. So it's probably not as essential as it was, but it's still valuable in its own right, just because of that whole experience that you come with it, I would say.
Yeah, thanks very much for that great answer. I mean, I kind of couldn't agree more. So for anyone, any sort of young person listening, who, if you have the sort of, you know, money and time to do it, I would highly recommend it. I mean, one sort of funny reason I kind of give for it is, like, it's basically a kind of introduction to kind of like middle-class professional life, because you're going to meet people who are going to be in other fields. So you're going to meet, you know, like, if I have an issue with the law, I call my lawyer friends. You know, if I have an issue with something on my back, I could call my doctor friends and things like that. But like, also those professions and all those things other people do become much more familiar to you, but you're much less intimidating and strange, because you're there with other people who are 18 years old learning these things for the first time. You remember how they were like after that party, and now they're the mayor of the city, you know, like, and there's just so much like that comes with the experience in your youth of spending 3 or 4 years in study with other people, that just has its kind of indescribable value in the rest of your life.
Yeah, 100% that. It's very much about the experience, the friends you build. You know, we're still friends with the majority of our friendship group is still kind of from 30 years ago now.
That's like, thanks for sharing that really great answer. And of course, but at the same time, of course, you know, one thing that often comes up when I ask that question is, you know, what you brought up, which is, but do you need to get a job in IT? That's actually a different question. And then that sort of starts to matter, like, what is there, if there's a specific industry you want to get in, like if you want to get into like defense, there might be constraints that are just written out, like they can only hire people with university degrees or something like that, and people who only live in certain places and things like that. So you want to look at, if there is a specific industry you want to go into, you want to look into that. So before we move on to the next part of the interview, where we move away from the personal and talk mm-hmm. about your book and the books that inspired it, which is actually a very interesting thing, I wanted to ask you a personal question. So it's in your bio, so I get to. So you've got a third degree black belt in a type of karate that I'd never heard of before. So I've got a little bit of a martial arts background myself. I've done a fair amount of reading, but I'd never heard of this. So I was yes. looking it up a little bit last night, and I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about this style that you study.
Yeah, cool. It's something I'm really, really passionate about, actually, and was introduced to it at university, so in 1996, The sensei is called Ian Smith. At the time, it was kind of a new thing. Initially, it was called Zen Shorindo. There's an author called Nathan Johnson, who's written a few books, but Barefoot Zen is the kind of one of the key books behind it all. And they actually did a lot of research into the history of martial arts, looking at, well, we have Kung Fu and we have karate, and there's some katas and things that look very similar, but there's bits that aren't the same. And so what happened? Where did it all diverge? And so there's sort of researched right to the history of it and traced it back to the Shaolin roots of karate and kung fu. Mm-hmm. And so if it started then at the Shaolin temple, and yet it's all about smashing people in the face, that doesn't quite ring true. So like what is it actually for? If it's not for smashing people in the face. I mean, it's very effective at that, but is there something more to it? And so they boiled it back to like three main katas. So actually, when you look at a lot of karate styles, you've got 15, 20 different katas. But actually, when you break those down, there's three main ones, one called Sanshin, which is the sort of archetypal kata. Then you've got Naifunshin, and you have Rokushu. And with those three, when you look at most of the other katas, they all contain elements of those, but reinterpreted. So then they looked at what's the application of every single one of those, and how does that apply? And really then looking at, well, actually, when you then say, if karate is from the Shaolin temple, and in the Shaolin temple, they meditate. And so if you're meditating and you're, say, the sensei or the master, and you need to test whether someone's meditating or not, or test whether their mind is empty, you can't do that externally. Only that person knows whether they're thinking about putting the dishwasher on or something like that, right? It's in their own head. But if you're in contact with somebody and you're doing something that we call pushing hands, so you're pushing hands with that person, you're in contact, and we call it rolling on the corner. So you're rolling with your partner, and then at some point you just throw a back fist into their face. If they're thinking about putting the dishwasher on, then they're not going to respond in time, because they're not in the moment, truly in the moment. And so it's kind of we train the body to train the mind ultimately. So the focus is very much on learning all of the skills that you could punch somebody in the face with, but actually use it to test yourself to truly be in the moment. So we go and practice, we do these pushing hands practices where you can actually experience really being present, which is very cool.
Yeah, thanks very much for sharing that. I mean, it's always great to hear the, you know, people talk about martial arts and grounding it in history, and the kind of, you know, shared history that a lot of kind of Chinese and Japanese martial arts have. It's interesting you talk about pushing hands. In the sort of style of Kung Fu that I studied for a few years in Montreal, that was a big part of it. And it's interesting. Like, that's like of all the things I've carried with me the most since, if there was one specific thing I could talk about, it would be that in particular. It's kind of hard to describe. There's, if you want to look up sticky hands or pushing hands, you'll see it online. But like, yeah, basically what you do is, you, one version of it is you sort of like, you know, you, you touch forearms with someone standing in front of you and you move in a circle. And then at a certain point in time, you try and like tap them on the head or on the shoulder or something like that. And eventually you learn to kind of deflect the other person's attempt to do that by just sensing and watching and stuff like that. And one trick I always used to do for fun on sort of new, relatively new students was I'd move my right foot and touch their my front foot and touch their front foot with it. And right. But every single time they'd look down and then you tap them on the head. And it's that there's a subtlety to that kind of like no mind kind of thing, right? Which is like, you wouldn't be distracted by that in that way if you were present in the way that you're supposed to be. So it's not it's not just to treat you like, it's to teach you about how you should be sensing yourself.
Yes.
Exactly. And self-aware when you're doing that.
Completely that. It's building self-awareness, just even the kind of subtleties in your body positioning. You know, are you fully relaxed? Have you got skeletal integrity? So have you got your arms in the right position so that you don't have to use your muscles and all those kind of things? So yeah, it's very much a self-reflective trying to be present, I guess. And that's it's a nice break from digital and all of that kind of stuff, just to get out there and just empty your mind. It's good.
Yeah, no, that's really good. It's just the last thing I'll say, because I could talk about this forever, but like, and thank you for indulging the digression. But when you talk about getting away from digital life, actually, traditionally, one of the functions that martial arts played in villages was giving young people something to do. So there's a lot of elements of martial arts that, you know, for example, like if you look at a kind of kung fu school, there might be like 100 different weapons on the wall. And, you know, if you're kind of practically minded, you'd be like, what are those all 100 weapons? And it's like, well, because someone's kind of going to be coming in for an hour a day from when they're like, you know, 10 to when they're 90. And you want to keep them interested, you know, and you want to use sort of like, that's a sword person or like, that's a hammer person and stuff like that. And so giving people something to do, to stay healthy, to think about other things than, you know, whether they're, you know, a farmer or, you know, the mayor or whatever, you know, it gives them something to think about. So there's this, one of the reasons there's such a rich depth to martial arts is those dimensions of things.
Keeping people active and especially with the, you know, the touch reflex side of stuff, you know, that's because it's constantly using the brain and it's the last thing to go actually. Like, so you still get that touch reflex.
That's a really good point.
And you know, stay really active. I mean, you look at the old masters in Asia and stuff, and they just keep on going. They seem to like still have it, all of their senses, well into their 100 years old.
Yeah, it's amazing. And obviously, we would both recommend it to anyone listening who's thinking of something new to do in your life. So, thank you for the digression. But now, moving on to the next part of the interview, where we talk about your book. It's User Needs Mapping: Aligning Teams Around What Matters. So. One of the very interesting things I liked about your story that you were telling was the role that like books or in a specific book, the Team Topologies book, played in what you're doing. And in particular, it was that once there's a book about something, there's a shared resource that people can have on a team. You know, instead of coming up with some kind of arbitrary analogy about bathtubs, you can be like, no, there's a book out there when you're talking to your client or your managers or whatever about a new process. So there's this very interesting history in software development of books being written on various subjects and helping teams kind of go in different directions. And there are two very specific kind of like ideas that informed your user needs mapping. One of them is Wardley mapping and one of them is the team topologies. So I thought in building up to talking about user needs mapping, I was wondering if you could talk for a minute about a couple minutes about Wardley mapping and then about team topologies. So you don't have to remember the order or anything like that, but so let me ask, what is Wardley mapping?
So Wardley mapping was created by a guy called Simon Wardley. And he is a self-confessed failed CEO who basically, if you've ever seen him speak at conferences, but essentially back in 2000 and something, he was struggling with his business. Like he just basically felt like he had imposter syndrome. Like he didn't know what he was doing. Like strategy was based on randomness. He didn't really have any sense of what they were doing, why they were doing it. And he thought, this isn't quite right. So I need to actually try to understand what's happening. And he actually turned to Sun Tzu's Art of War, the book. I think he read like 3 or 4 different copies of it. Mm. And he said, well, if that applies to kind of the battlefield, well, the companies are fighting in their own battlefield, right? So everyone's in competition. We have supply and demand competition. And so actually, can we take those principles from the battlefield and apply them to business? So from a strategic perspective, can we apply those? So essentially, there's 5 kind of core elements, but firstly, what's your moral imperative? What's your purpose for being? Why are you there? Then it's understanding sort of what's the landscape. Where are you actually fighting your battle? Then you need to take into account what's the climatic patterns. What's going to be happening around you that might change the landscape? So you're making decisions around that. Then you've got your doctrinal principles. So like, how do you actually do things? How do you send your troops in? Or how do you train your people within your staff? And then you have sort of leadership stratagems. So what's the strategies that you're going to apply within the marketplace? And it follows this John Boyd's kind of OODA loop. So observe, orient, decide, act. And so it's really, going back to the landscape, to capture the landscape, we use a map. And the key thing about a map is that you have an anchor. So an anchor is like north, true north is, and then based on the anchor of true north and the drawing of the map, which is the countries, when you move from one country to another on the map, it changes what the meaning. It changes the meaning of if you're in London and you move to the US, then you moved like on the map. But when you're in business and you're looking at, say, a SWOT analysis of your strengths, weaknesses, etc., or any typical graph, there's no implication of movement. So you can move things around, but you're not moving. It's not changing the meaning. So a Wardley map then anchors on the user. So who's the user? What is their need? So that's our north. And then we have the capabilities or the components that we build in order to meet those needs. So what is the company bringing to the table? And the movement on the map is then the evolution of those capabilities. So every product or component or capability will often start in Genesis. So it's brand new. No one's ever heard of it before. And then over time, it will evolve to become a commodity.
Right.
So electricity was brand new once, and now it's a complete commodity. And the same with the internet, the same with mobile phones. You're just expecting them to exist. And then as things become commoditized, we start to build new things on top of the commodity. So that's the kind of, in a nutshell, the Wardley mapping principle. You map out your landscape, you understand what capabilities you have and its evolutionary state, and also what your doctrinal principles are, and then what stratagems you're going to apply in order to win in the market. So it's a way of thinking about strategically, how is your organization going to win? And he was responsible for Ubuntu's success within the kind of cloud space. Well, it was very much involved in that. So he applied mapping to enable that to happen.
Okay. Okay. So, and just to drill in a little bit, so we're thinking about with sort of a map is like a sheet of paper, you can think of it, and there's an X axis and a Y axis.
Yeah.
And the X axis goes from not commodified to commodified,
yes,
if I understand correctly. And so basically what that means is if something is on the left, that means I need to build it.
Yes.
And if something's on the right, that means I can probably just buy it.
Exactly that.
Right. Okay. Okay. And as if I build something new, I know that over time it's just going to become a commodity. There's going to be an interchange. There basically will be other interchangeable instances of it that people can use. And so now the vertical axis is going, as you said, the north is going towards the user. Mm-hmm. And so is that vertical axis value, and or is it invisibility to visibility to the user?
Yeah, it's typically the closer to the user it is, the more visible it is.
To the user.
Yep, to the user.
Okay.
So what's the thing that they interact with first? What's visibly closer? And then the further down the value chain you go, the further away from the customer, the less visible those components are. So I might use a website and I'm interacting with a browser, but there is a server somewhere that depends on, and it's running in the cloud somewhere. So the full value chain of us having this conversation in Zoom is a massive connection of different capabilities all the way down to electricity and that if you want to, but we're not aware of those parts of the map.
Right. So that's interesting. So just drawing on my own experience working for a big company one time, we had an internal document system that they licensed, a global internal documentation system. So that would probably be on the bottom right of a Wordly map because the user's never going to see it. They're never going to know what it is or that we have it or that we use it. It's crucial to everything that we do, but it's a commoditized thing that the user's never going to see or know about. But like a product I've got my hands, you can't see it because I've changed the magnification here, but like anyway, I'll get used to it. But like on the top left would be like, let's say like what the app that we're building looks like to the user when they kind of open it on their phone.
Exactly.
And at the end, it's brand new and we're inventing it and stuff like that. So then that would be on the top left. And then I have all the various capabilities or functions or things like that my company has then can be laid out across this map.
And exactly. Based on its evolution stage. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's the idea. So then you're starting to make decisions about based on the evolution of those capabilities, what methods you might apply. So if it's brand new or you're building it, you might want to apply sort of agile ways of working. But if it's highly commoditized, you're not expecting that to change very often.
Right.
So even how you approach developing the system will change as the evolution of that capability changes.
Okay.
And if we're aware of that evolution, then we start to understand why the dynamics of the team might change as the product evolves.
Okay. That's what a great explanation. Okay. Thank you very much. That sort of clarified a lot for me that I've been curious about over the years. And so the second thing, was team topologies, that inform user needs mapping. And so by Matthew Skelton and Manuel Pice, I've never pronounced his name out loud before, but, and so could you talk a little bit about team topologies and what that is?
Yeah, 100%. So I've been hands-on software development for a long time. I got into Agile early, like 2003, I think. So doing Scrum, got my kind of training wheels of doing Agile, Lean, all of those bits and pieces over the years. And we always spoke about cross-functional teams, but we never really had a language for describing it effectively that we could share across the organization. Being kind of really clear about what makes a good team or what what capabilities that team needs in order to be effective across the organization. So we'd end up with like component teams or feature teams or project teams, like, but no real kind of underlying principles to define what makes an effective organization and what team structures, or not necessarily team structures, team interactions. And this is a really key part. And so what Teams Apologies for me brings to the table is clarity around the shared language that we can use to describe what an effective organization can look like, but breaking it down into it's 3.5 basic team types or team topologies, and then 3 interaction nodes. So it's really kind of taking a socio-technical systemic view of the organization. So every organization is made up of people, process, and technology. And we need to pay attention to how the technology and the social side need to change together to be effective. Now, you know, Taylorism was very much kind of command and control perspective. So like you have the brain, which is the management, and then the workers just need to do the work. You just need to tell them what to do. And that was fine for a long, long time. But as the rate of change within technology is accelerating, organizations that are still trying to work in that kind of command and control disconnected way are starting to sort of struggle to keep up because they can't evolve quickly enough to cater to kind of take into account all the new changes in the ways of working. And so what Team Topologies brings is a language to start to reason about, well, how are we organized? And are we organized in a way that allows the organization to adapt as the world around it changes? So we have the 3 team types are a streamlined team. If you only had one team type in your organization, it would be that.
Right.
And that is a team of 5 to 9 people, probably get smaller now that we've got AI, but this was the basic premise. But they have end-to-end responsibility for delivering value to whoever their user is. But they should have all of the capabilities that they need in order to do that. And then if you think about any kind of modern software delivery team, that's a big stack, right? They've got to keep in their head all of the product management. They need application security. They need monitoring. They need all of these things. That team of 5 to 9 people, that's a lot for them to keep into their head. So, of course, all of that stuff is going to exceed their cognitive capacity. And there's only so much we can keep in our heads at any one time. And so they're going to need support. And the support comes in the form of the other team types, which is an enabling team, which would typically be there to help with what we call intrinsic cognitive load. So that's the kind of skills that people need in order to do their job. So if you think about a software developer, I need to know, say, if I do Java, you know, Java Beans, or if I do C#, what's a class? I need to know how to write good unit tests, all of those things. So that's intrinsic cognitive load. And our enabling team is there to help spot when a team doesn't have the right capabilities. They'll go and work with that team, upskill that team, and then move away. And that's really an important part of that enabling team, is they're not doing the work. They're working with the team to give the team that capability. Then the next team is a platform team, and they work in the context of reducing extraneous cognitive load. And extraneous cognitive load are the things that need to be done, or the kind of the environmental things that need to be there to deliver the value, but they're not directly related to the problem that the Streamline team is trying to solve. So those platform teams are then there to help understand what's relevant to the Streamline team, but what's something we can extract away so that that team can then, what we call self-service, that capability. So how do we, the platform teams are there to improve the flow of value of the Streamline team whilst reducing their cognitive load. So that's the two kind of core principles. And then the final team is what we call a complicated subsystem team, which is kind of like a mini platform, but ultimately it's slightly more specialized. So that team would have people with, say, PhD level experience where machine learning or something like that, that right. you just want to abstract away those elements. So really, so those core kind of principles are, we use those as sort of like magnets to say, well, let's look at an organization. And if we know that effective organizations work in those ways, so we've got Streamline teams that deliver end-to-end value, and we have other teams that are improving the flow of value of those teams and reducing their cognitive load, we can then start to look at our organizations and say, well, this is what we want to aim for. Where are we today? And typically many organizations today have got lots of handovers between teams. You might have a product management or a project management office, a series of project-based teams where we're spinning up teams and tearing down. We might have a test team or an operations team, and lots of handovers between those teams. And those handovers are killing the flow of value to the end customer. So,
okay, great. Well, you've done a really good job of spontaneously kind of explaining these two big kind of, you know, conceptual foundations that go into your work. So that now I finally get to ask you the question: what was the aha moment that led you to develop user needs mapping?
Cool. Yes, indeed. So basically, yes, I'd been learning about Audley mapping, and I thought this is really, really cool. But there's loads to take into account, right? There's doctrinal principles, there's all of those things. And then there's also team topologies, which is really awesome, but there's also a lot to kind of take in. And I was trying to... I was working with a client, and I wanted to try to quickly understand their landscape. I thought, Audley mapping has landscape stuff in it, right? So let's start with that. So just tell me who are the users. So we captured the users, and what needs are you serving? And then what capabilities? So like we just captured the services and things. And created the map, but I didn't want to go into the evolution phase. That would just like blow their mind, right? Let's not talk about evolution. Let's just keep with the value chain. So I've got a good understanding of what the basic and current mess looks like. And then the purpose we were trying to find, well, what are the value streams that exist within the organization? So by using the map, every value stream should end with a customer, right? A user. So we've already got our users and we've got the needs that we're serving, but we've got all of these services and capabilities that are connected, the dependencies between them. So if we're looking to deliver value, can we manipulate the map? Because we haven't got the evolution access, we can now manipulate the map free of evolution and start to say, actually, these capabilities are cohesive. Whenever something changes that meets that user need, these things would change together. And whenever something over this side, which meets, say, some other user's need, they would change together. So we can then use that map to say, well, if all of those things change together and all of these things change together, what if a team owned those things? So a stream-aligned team owned those capabilities, and that's our value stream to deliver value that meets that user need. And so
is really
by eliminating the kind of cognitive overload of Wardley mapping evolution, they'll get value from trying to identify potential value streams where we can start to move towards this team topologies ways of working.
Right, I see. Okay, so it's there's a actually it's, for anyone listening or watching, if you go to userneedsmapping.com, there's a really excellent example of a user needs map there that has at its top, I'm looking at it right now, a moviegoer.
Yes.
And then there's this really great, so now then you think about what are the things, like if I'm a cinema or whatever, like I'm my whatever business I'm in, the moviegoer is my user. So they need to be able to find a movie worth watching. They need to reserve seats. They need to be able to make a payment. They need to, I'm just saying the example here, like remember the showtime or seamless entry or something like that. And then there's the capabilities underneath those needs that are required to meet those needs. And then then you go like sort of down various layers of what we were talking about before of invisibility to the user. And so the really great thing about it is that, and what really clicked for me when you talked about, oh, this is about organizing teams. What teams do you need? Like, because if you just look at it that way, well, we need to find a movie worth watching team, and we need to know where and when to watch team, and we need a reserve seats team. And it's like, well, actually, if you move down, if you actually think of it in terms of what capabilities are required to meet those needs, then you can see, oh, actually, we can have one team that does this, but then that's connected to these eight different needs. And when you're designing that team, you can think about what they need to meet those needs, but what they can do to coherently together, given their skill set and their structure and things like that. That really clicked for me. That's really great that, user needs mapping is about organizing teams to meet those needs. That's just really fantastic. So I gave it the example from the website, userneedsmapping.com. But the book itself, you can buy it in various places. This is where now I'm going to transition to the third part of the interview, or the last part where we talk about your work as an author and a writer. So you used our upload writing mode on LeanPub. So you produced the ebook yourself some way. And I believe the book's in print as well. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, and believe it or not, there are people who skip to this part. They skip all the other stuff and they get to this part. They're like, how does someone write a book and self-publish it? So, how did you write your book? What tool, could you talk a little bit about what tools you used and how you published it?
Yeah. So basically I started off without the intention of writing a book. I was writing lots of articles about user needs mapping. I'd created the website, and initially I was thinking, I'll make a small like mini book, maybe 60 pages, something like that. Bring it together a few of the articles. So I actually, I'd written a lot already. So I used like Obsidian Vault to do my writing. So it was all in Markdown and things. But then I ended up started using Canva.
Oh.
And so put things into Canva because we thought I was going to be nice and quick. Now, my wife did multimedia journalism at university at the time.
Okay.
And she used to work for the National Institute of Clinical Excellence. So she used to take doctors' theses and things and turn them into something that the public could actually consume. So take all of those complicated words and make them sound consumable. Basically, I have my own stream-aligned team in the house. So I was producing the technical content, what I wanted to say. And I used her as a sounding board to what do you call it, techify it.
Right.
So I would try to explain to, well, so I'd write the thing and then to read it and go, what on earth is a streamlined team? And mm-hmm. why, who would even know what that is?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we bounce off. It's like, okay, well, maybe I don't need to introduce those things all the way through the book. So we worked really hard together as a pair, which has been a really good experience for us both. So it's kind of pair publishing. But she's also really, really great at typeset, like attention to detail.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we then worked together. Essentially, I built the content and things, but we ended up, so brought everything together. And then my wife and I kind of bouncing off to each other, and she's done all the typesetting. And she was really, really passionate about not making it look like we self-published.
Okay.
So hopefully, right. And I'm really happy with the quality of the book.
Oh, it looks great. Yeah.
But yeah, so it's amazing. But it was all done in Canva.
Okay.
Accidentally, I think. But yes, so combination of articles that I'd written, bringing it all together, and then we ended up in Canva and manually kind of, yeah. I wouldn't recommend it going forward.
Oh, well, it's I think we've heard from authors who've used Canva before, but yet, you know, there's like, you know, people find their own way. In particular with LeanPub authors who tend to be very technical. Like I've heard about people like, I don't know, like kind of some complex system of like Microsoft Word macros in order to produce an EPUB and kind of stuff. And so
I'm currently doing the EPUB at the moment, and so I'm using Calibre management. So and we've had to go back to HTML and CSS, and I've just been doing my accessibility checking. So
is your book in print as well?
Yes, so we started off in print, so that was the goal, was use Amazon KDP as the publishing mechanism, produce the PDF, and then upload it to LeanPub. Now, I think going forward, I think I've probably got another book in me. I think going forward, I think I would start with LeanPub and go from there, to be honest.
Yeah, we would definitely recommend that for any number of reasons, one of which is you can get the book out early and you can publish chapter by chapter and stuff like that. But one important point I always like to make to people in the end is that, like, in the end, you can, we've got an InDesign export or something like that. But when the manuscript is written, when it's all done, there's nothing stopping you then from doing the kind of professional book design formatting.
Yeah.
You can just view it as different stages and things like that. So since you didn't use LeanPub to write this book, but you used it to publish this book, your answer might be different than some other authors when I ask. But my last question that I always ask on the podcast when the guest is a LeanPub author is, if there was one magical feature we could build for you, or if there was one thing that has you every time you log in, you're just shaking your fist going, damn you, LeanPub, why does this particular thing suck so much, that we could fix for you? Can you think of anything that you would ask us to do?
I guess as a self-publisher, so when I did look, because I've not actually looked at the cost of InDesign, but I think InDesign is quite expensive.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that's why we sort of landed on Canva, because we were already paying for the license and that kind of thing. And that was the goal. So, and I didn't look into, I think when I scanned LeanPub, because I was looking for like, are we doing it in the right way? But because it wasn't necessarily going to help with the typesetting, I don't think, like, it was still produce an InDesign file and you'd still then need to do
InDesign bits.
So I think we just we committed so much to the Canva side that wasn't useful for us at that point. So I guess something around the typesetting, because that's been as a self-published author, that's probably one of the hardest parts. And if I didn't have my wife to be able to do that, that would be a complete and utter nightmare. And then I think there would be additional costs for somebody to do the InDesign bit. So I, whether there's sort of more typesetting elements, but it's tough to do, I think.
More formatting. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, a plain text based way of producing books is always going to have certain kind of formatting limitations. Yeah. Otherwise, the kind of, you know, specification to get technical would be as long as every single thing you could possibly do with a pixel in a book, PDF, basically. So there's always going to be limitations, but we do get that often from people, and we're always trying to improve, try to make it as good as it can be with as little effort from the author is kind of our goal. And then if you really want to do something like kind of highly professionally designed and unique, you find your own way to doing that, hopefully with some help from us. Well, the book is User Needs Mapping, Aligning Teams Around What Matters. Thank you so much for taking the time today to talk to me and to talk to all of us about your really great book and about your background and a little bit about martial arts too.
Indeed. Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And as always, thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the Front Matter Podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate and review it wherever you found it. And if you'd like to be a Lean Pub author yourself, please check out our website at leanpub.com. Thanks.